evening. This is Dr. Stan here on Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the story behind the story, the news behind the news, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, and illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality and not illusion or delusion that'll determine just what the future will bring. Now, I want to remind you that the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, and the views of our callers. But we're not going to have any callers this next hour, or if we do, it'll be at the very, very end of the time. And you'll know, and if you want to call us, of course, you can call us at 464-8295 or 1-800-5-TALK-AT-ME. But our subject for this hour is going to be, is there a war on drugs? You know, we see this war on drugs being fought, and we see the advertisements, and we see the government taking a tremendous action. They're confiscating people's property. If there's even the slightest amount of drugs, half of the young black men, between a third and half of the young black men in America today, are either on parole or in prison. Our prisons are bursting out because of people on drugs. And the question is there really a war on drugs? You know, we have amazing satellite technology where our satellites can see an individual, read the newspaper, read a license plate from outer space. Now, we have the technology to be able to listen to conversations from a long distance away. We have so much electronic gadgetry. You'd think that if we really wanted to stop the influx of drugs into America, we could really do it. Are we doing it? And if we're not, is there some other motive behind the war on drugs? Well, this evening we're going to play a series of tapes of previous interviews, and of course this is going to be part of a four tape set that Radio Liberty will offer. And so, first of all, we want to start out with an interview I did with Colonel Bogreit some year and a half ago. It's shortly after he had rescued Vicki Weaver from... Randy Weaver. The government was going to go in and kill Randy and his three children the next day. I've forgotten whether there were two, maybe there were two daughters left. But anyway, there were three, actually. There was the baby and then the two girls. And the government had said, if you don't get them out today, you know, we're going in tomorrow. It doesn't matter. And so Colonel Bogreit had been able to talk Randy Weaver and into surrendering and the girls into coming out. You see, they didn't trust the government because they knew the government had killed their brother, that had killed the mother, and they knew that they'd been targeted for destruction. At least that was their feeling. So let's listen to Colonel Bogreit as he tells us a little bit about some of his concerns about confiscation, the way the government is seizing property, and then takes us into the background of the drug running in Southeast Asia and the involvement of the United States government in that. So here's Colonel Bogreit.
I think it's important for people listening, because in California, Weaver's situation wasn't exceptional. In California, in 3 months, there were three instances where law enforcement, without knocking, simply bashed the door in, and in two cases, people were shot and killed. It seems that we have a law enforcement system run amok because of the confiscation laws that are now part of this war on drugs. It means that if there's any way at all that they can plant drugs or find any kind of evidence of drugs, that they can take everything you have, not only your bank account, not only your home, vehicles, and personal effects, but anything that you literally own.
Well, now that gets to another subject, and I want to cover a couple of quick things because I want to talk a little bit about Southeast Asia. First of all, you're going into Vietnam, and secondly, you're going into the area between Burma and Laos and your association there with the drug lord, because I think this is vital to understanding why we have a drug epidemic in America today.
Well, it begins with the Vietnam War and a liberal Congress. I commanded an army of Cambodians. As a matter of fact, Francis Ford Coppola got in touch with me in 1975. I was commander of special forces in Latin America. Francis Ford Coppola was making the movie Apocalypse Now, which was the first movie about Vietnam. He wanted to use General William C. Westmoreland in his memoirs, named me as the American soldier. And he talked about my Cambodian army in his book, and there was a photograph in there of myself kneeling in front of a lot of really mean-looking Cambodian mercenaries. He wanted to use the photograph out of Westmoreland's book to superimpose Marlon Brando's face over mine because he had written a story, a fictional story, about Colonel Kurtz, and I was Major Greitz, and there was this Cambodian mercenary army, and I actually had one. We worked cross-border operations in areas where Americans couldn't go or weren't supposed to go, and the war in Laos and Cambodia was not funded by the U.S. Congress. Matter of fact, the U.S. Congress forbid any military forces in those areas. But Air America, there's another movie, and it was interesting that it was very factual. Air America, while kind of national lampoonish, was nonetheless correct about the CIA airline flying, among pigs and rice and other things, dope. The war in Laos and Cambodia was paid for by illegal narcotics. And, of course, those illegal narcotics were brought back to America and used to overdose this nation. It didn't stop, of course, with Vietnam. It continued on because once you make your bed with the devil, then you've got to sleep with him, and it is not easy to get out of bed. 500 entries, for example, in Ollie North's diaries on the Iran-Contra talked to illegal drug operations paying for the Contra operations. I commanded Special Forces Latin America 1975 to 1977, same time George Bush was head of the CIA. It's all public record. I knew Manuel Antonio Noriega personally. The CIA, under its director, George Bush, had an operation going on called Operation Watchtower, wherein the CIA was flying cocaine out of Bogota, Colombia, landing at Albrook Army Airfield in Panama. The money was laundered through the banks that Noriega controlled, and the drugs, of course, like a tsunami, came into southeastern United States. And the money was being used by the intelligence agencies as liquid cash to do what it was that a liberal Congress would not permit legally. And so the whole issue, unfortunately, of prisoners of war ties in with government drug use. How does it tie in? It's rather bizarre. The Assistant Secretary of Defense used to be Richard Armitage. He was identified to me by the drug lord Kun Sa. Kun Sa was indicted by the U.S. Attorney General as being the most heinous drug criminal in the history of the world. He controls most of the heroin that comes into the free world. His headquarters is in Burma, in the Golden Triangle, and I was one of the first U.S. agents ever to go in and come out alive. I didn't go in on my own initiative. I went in because I was sent, ironically, by the White House in search of prisoners of war. Kun Sa says that Armitage was a bagman for a government drug operation and that laundered money through the Nugenhan Bank. Well, we know from reading Jonathan Quitney, a reporter for the Wall Street Journal, wrote a book called Crimes of Patriots, and it was all about the Nugenhan Bank. Well, I knew Michael Hand. He's a special forces operative. The Nugen was an Australian. The bank was set up, had chapters all over the world run by admirals and generals. The bank had one purpose, to launder CIA drug money. It finally all came public when Michael Hand fled Australia and Nugen was found dead, shot by a rifle that was too long for him to have pulled the trigger except with his toe, and he had his shoes on. He was found lying dead in his Mercedes in Australia. So this whole thing began to come apart. So Armitage was the bagman. Now, if that is true, then it means that Armitage, who was, as the Assistant Secretary of Defense, responsible for bringing home prisoners of war, would not want any prisoners of war to come home, because when the first one did, he, meaning Armitage, would be investigated as the bureaucrat responsible, and why didn't they come home 15 years ago? And Armitage, I believe, and Bush and others feared that there would be an investigation. It would be determined that these bureaucrats had not been pursuing U.S. prisoners of war, but rather using their office of special trust and confidence to run drugs. for money that would pay for continued purchase of arms around the world when the Congress wouldn't do it legally.
Now, would you tell the listening audience what happened when you came back to the United States and reported this to the White House? You're finding that Richard Armitage was involved in the drug trade.
As bizarre as a lot of this sounds, it is public record. There has been a trial held, and a lot of documents, affidavits that I have. As a matter of fact, I even printed them in a book. The name of the book is Called to Serve. So it's proof right there. So the things I'm going to say, while they sound extremely weird, are nonetheless absolutely true. When I went into the Golden Triangle, and I had a CIA polygraph machine, for example, Scott David Weekly, he lives down in San Diego, a Navy SEAL that was a classmate of Ollie North, went with me. We were the first two agents to go in and come out alive. I speak, read, write Chinese. So does Kun Sa. It was helpful. Point is, he didn't have any prisoners, but he released a lot of information about his government, U.S. government, drug contacts. And when I came out of Burma, there was a phone call waiting for me. The State Department was saying, they already knew. And, of course, if listeners don't understand it, let me explain how in the jungles of Burma, the State Department would already know what had happened. Satellites, as you know, can photograph your license plate from outer space. They can also vacuum up your conversations if that's what they want to do. The National Security Agency has the best electronic eavesdropping ever in the history of the world. And so it was apparently that important that when we came out of Burma, I was told if I did not erase and forget all of the information that I had gathered, I was going to, quote, hurt the government. I'm pretty hard-headed. I got shot in the back of the head in Vietnam. The bullet bounced off. I'm not bulletproof, but I am hard-headed. It just made me angry. I said, whose government? And they said, listen, Bo, don't make the government go drama. If you do not cooperate, erase and forget, we will send you to prison as a felon for 15 years. Well, I told them to stick it up their kilt. And I'll tell you, I felt like a gnat being charged upon by a herd of elephants, with some pun intended. It started out being Mr. Meese, and then it went on to the next attorney general. It took 2 years. They tried to prosecute me for training Afghans. I'm guilty. They tried to prosecute me for violation of the Neutrality Act. I'm guilty. I've been into communist Asia 10 times in search of prisoners of war, never once asked permission of those governments.
But they finally did
prosecute me because they couldn't get a grand jury indictment on the others. The grand jury saw through the facade. But I was prosecuted for using false passports. What a weenie charge. I've used false passports all my adult life. My lawyer said, Bo, please stop saying before the media that you're guilty. But I was, not of the spirit of the law, but of the letter of the law.
But
bottom line was I was acquitted.
For the sake of the audience, will you explain that you were actually working under special orders from the White House and you were being funded by a special fund set up? Wasn't it Ross Perot that set up the funds so that you could do these things? How did that all tie in?
It is a small world. Ross Perot ended up being a candidate for president. I think he was an insider. The purpose was to draw off the protest and patriot vote, and he did an excellent job of it.
But
in those days, Perot was asked by the government to sponsor my prisoner of war activities because the government did not want to recognize there were any prisoners of war. If we succeeded in getting him out alive, now knowing what I know, I think all of us would have just disappeared, like in the Bermuda Triangle or something. We'd have just dropped out of sight. But in those days, I didn't realize that Big Brother and Great White Father were some of our worst enemies. And I had some faith in the government, and so we and others with me, Gary Goldman from Los Angeles, Scott David Weekly from San Diego, we went into Laos time and time again to set up and rescue U.S. prisoners of war. Every time, something happened in the very last moments before a rescue that denied us our victory. I'm not a beginner at special operations. The reason Westmoreland selected me as an example of the American soldier is we ran 100 successful special operations in communist Asia. We even got back a U-2 spy plane that had been captured intact. Unlike the Francis Gary Powers plane, this plane had not destructed its vital electronics. And the White House had said, you get in there and get that at all costs, and we succeeded. It should have been relatively easy to have brought out U.S. prisoners of war. I was just absolutely dumbfounded for a number of years, not knowing, not being able to believe that that we had met the enemy, as Pogo says, and he is us.
And basically,
right out of the White House.
And basically, you feel that every time you were just about ready to get the prisoners out, somebody on our side was betraying you?
Somebody on our side was right there who knew every step to pull the rug out from under us. For example, in 1983, we were about 10 kilometers. We were in what is known as a attack position. We were preparing ammunition and the assault force that would have, I believe, rescued 30 American prisoners at a place called Namarat. The American prisoners were confirmed by satellite photography. They were there. We had reconfirmed them by ground reconnaissance, and we would have been on the ground at Namarat the next day. And yet that night at 7 p.m., Yankee Doodle Dandy starts playing in the jungle because all of our resistance forces are faithful listeners to Radio Free, what is it called, Radio Free America, and they wanted to know what the truth of the news was. Well, in Lao, speaking to our enemies, a U.S. State Department translator said, quote, Green Beret Commander Bo Greitz is leading 16 American Special Forces in a raid to rescue American prisoners of war at Namarat and Sapone. Now, Sapone was our alternate target. So I guess they figured if they didn't catch us at Namarat, they'd maybe catch us at Sapone.
Yeah, in other words,
it not only made it impossible, because we almost lost our lives, we were almost captured ourselves. It not only made it impossible to continue the rescue, but we, like I say, matter of fact, a real snake in the grass by the name of Spivey came up to my bride in Los Angeles and said, Mrs. Greitz, there is 99% chance your husband is never coming out alive. You need, for your own security and the security of your children, the money that we'll give you. For the rights to this story. And my wife, I take some satisfaction, said, you don't know my husband very well. And so we were able to make it out, but it certainly wasn't any thanks to the U.S. government. Matter of fact, later I was at the wall in Vietnam, in the Vietnam Wall in Washington, D.C., and a young lady came up to me, and she said, Colonel, you don't know me, but I know you. She said, when you were on that prisoner of war rescue, I was working the Army Security Agency out of the Philippines. We were ordered by Washington, D.C., Defense Intelligence Agency, to find you electronically at all cost. We were told that you would be killed if we weren't able to locate you. She said, we searched and searched and searched, and finally, she said, we were able to fix your position. She felt real proud because she thought she had saved our lives, and in fact, she had been tricked, and so was her signal intercept unit, and what they had really wanted to do was find us, I think, for destruction.
Well, now, would you tell us the story?
Okay, now, we're going to just flip over the tape here, and we'll get to the rest of the story. It's an amazing story, so don't even think about changing that dial, and we're back to Colonel Greitz.
Traffic in Washington, D.C., and you wouldn't keep quiet. What happened at the trial?
Well, it started in the U.S. Congress. There's a man by the name of Lawrence Smith. He is the chairman of the House Drug Oversight Committee, and I think that's a proper term. He comes from Miami Vice, Florida. He's still the congressman down there. And I had videotapes of Coonsaw naming his best customers with about 25 of his heroin factory commanders present to verify what he was saying. He had given us written records as well as made verbal statements on videotape for all these good congressmen to see. I had hoped that they would start an investigation. If Armitage was innocent, let's give him a medal. But if he is guilty, my heavens, it's the reason our prisoners aren't home. And it involved even George Bush, since George Bush appointed him, and even George Bush promoted him to Assistant Secretary of State right after that. But in this case, Lawrence Smith would not allow the congressional committee members to even view the videotapes. He told me, he said, quote, Colonel, how could a man of your intelligence put any stock at all in what a warlord would say? And I said, well, Mr. Smith, if you want to get rid of the missiles, you talk to Gorbachev, because he controls them. If you want to get rid of the heroin, you better talk to the guy who controls it, and that's Kunsa. Then Smith very rapidly said, because there was actually a highway that was built from Thailand's Mae Hong Song Airport right straight to Kunsa's inner sanctum, and there were 10-ton Thai military vehicles bringing out heroin at much greater rates than they ever did on muleback. And he said, well, now, Colonel, what's this business about a heroin highway? He says, how do we know that that is not a road to attack Kunsa? And when I replied, well, Mr. Chairman, if that is a road to attack, they aren't attacking, but they are hauling out heroin on 10-ton military trucks. He instantly said, I don't think we need to listen to this anymore. We've heard all we need to hear. And that was the end of it. Eventually, I was acquitted. And the U.S. attorney, when it was all over, he is appointed by the president. The U.S. attorney, his name is William Maddox, stood on the Foley Federal Building Court, and before video cameras of the television crews and before print journalists, when he was asked, why were you prosecuting Colonel Bo Greitz? And he said, quote, and it's right on, matter of fact, we still have videotapes showing all of Kunsa's comments that people can see if they want and see Maddox. Maddox says, quote, George Bush called me up and told me to get Bo Greitz. A member of the print journal corps didn't believe him, and he said, are you denying that? This is the quote. Are you denying that? Is that what you're saying? And Bill Maddox straightens himself up and very soberly says, quote, no. What I'm saying is George Bush called me up and told me to get Bo Greitz. Now, it's just as simple as that.
Well, now, how can members of our audience get copies of the tape and or your book?
Yeah, it's pretty easy. All they've got to do is they can write to me at just Bo Greitz, G-R-I-T-Z. I live way out in the country south of Las Vegas. All they got to do is just put Bo Greitz, G-R-I-T-Z, Sandy Valley, Nevada, 89019.
89019.
Yes, or they can call. The number here is 602 at my home. That's Arizona. 702-723-5266 is my telephone number. And I'll send them a free newsletter that tells all about, this month we're featuring some very interesting things about what's going on with the Constitutional Convention, the Weaver situation, and the employment and the economy and this kind of thing. We send them out to everybody a free newsletter. And if they want the book and the tape, they can just order it right through the newsletter.
All right. Now, do you actually have the Assistant Attorney General telling that story on tape? Is that available?
We have, because it was on television news. I didn't know that it happened. I was so happy to be out from under the elephant's foot and to be acquitted that I went my own way. But the news media collected around the U.S. attorney. And that night I turned on the television, and here on NBC, CBS, ABC, it didn't go nationally.
No.
It was like there was a big bowl put over Las Vegas. But it was on the Las Vegas news. It had Maddox making it. So I just turned the VCR on. As a matter of fact, the next day I took the VCR tape and I sent it to George Bush and Mr. Thornburg, who was the Attorney General, and said, if you did this, you did wrong. You tried to subvert government and justice. If you did not do it, then your U.S. attorney is lying about you. Well, Mr. Maddox lost his job. As a matter of fact, they not only took Mr. Maddox out, but they took the chief deputy and his assistant. So it basically cleared the boards in the great state of Nevada of U.S. attorneys for quite some time.
Well, you know, it's frightening to think that we have people in government who will do that, but I think it's interesting for our listeners to realize that you never heard this story before. We have such a degree of censorship over the media in America that important stories telling various aspects of what's going on are just totally blacked out, and you're not going to hear them in Santa Cruz. Some things happening in Nevada or happening in Florida, they totally isolate us, and that's why Radio Liberty here is so very important. Now, we're going to open up our lines here in just a minute at 464-8295 if you'd like to call in. That's 464-8295 if you have a comment or question. You told a story one time about when you were serving with the Special Forces in Central America. And, of course, you knew that Noriega was into drugs, and you knew that he had a lot to do. And you actually had requested permission to perhaps take Mr. Noriega out as one of the major drug lords. What happened at that time?
Well, I'm not real proud to say it, but it was part of my mission. I was the commander of Special Forces Latin America. My mission, which is, I've got official orders stating this, says this officer was responsible for unconventional warfare in Latin America. Unconventional warfare includes guerrilla warfare, sabotage, subversion, espionage. It also includes assassinations and direct action missions. And it was, and what had happened is my best friend is a man named, or was, because he was killed. And one reason he was killed is because of what I'm about to say. A.J. Baker was one of the best, he was the best officer I'd ever known in my life. He was a colonel. He had formed the 2nd Battalion of the 75th Rangers at Fort Lewis, Washington. A.J. had come down to Panama in 1975 in December to see me. He had been appointed by the CIA as the mission commander for an operation that was codenamed Watchtower. And A.J. Thought it rather strange, and we talked about it, that his teams were set up at Bogota, Colombia, Turbo, Colombia, right on the border of Panama. This comes through the Darien Mountains, which are very treacherous. And the idea was that CIA aircraft, because the Army would set up these towers and give them beacons that the CIA aircraft could fly beneath the radar mask, which means lower than 500 feet above the ground at night, through these rough mountains. The only way they could do it and stay alive was through these beacons that were set up by A.J. Baker's people. A.J. and I began to both investigate. We found out that the CIA and the Israeli Mossad were working together. There was a man named Michael Herrera that had come from Mexico City representing, not Herrera, but Herrera, representing the Israeli Mossad. If you got to remember now, 73 was the Yom Kippur War, and they had another war in 68. They were just tired of being besieged by their Arab enemies around them, and yet the Israelis did not have the money, literally, to buy up their enemies. And so at that time, Israel was using every imaginable means to collect money. They sold jet engines. For example, Pratt & Whitney. We gave Israel many Pratt & Whitney jet engines. They were not supposed to sell them. They're supposed to use them themselves for their own defense. But instead, they sold them, I know for a fact, because they sold them to Latin American countries like Honduras. And they were caught doing it. It's public record. But the Israelis were training mercenaries, and they actually opened up, through Michael Herrera and the CIA, this drug connection that allowed so much cocaine to come into America. The idea was, listen, Americans don't take drugs. The people that do are un-American. And so let's just get rid of them. And that was the justification for the CIA to do this. When we found this out, that Noriega was the kingpin, it came to my mind that part of our mission was assassination of enemies of the United States. Already, my goodness, thousands of good Latin American innocent people had been killed by their governments. In El Salvador and Nicaragua and Honduras and in other countries. And so I didn't think this was exceptional. I was amazed when the chief of, I know it's a misnomer, but chief of military intelligence named Harold Aaron came to see me. He didn't send a message. And he said, Bo, this is quote, Bo, you keep your hands off of Manuel Noriega. He has immense value at the highest levels, end quote. And matter of fact, we were given an order not to conduct any further assassination, political-type assassinations. And so Manuel Antonio Noriega was let off the hook. The reason that he didn't expose anything in his Miami trial is because of a thing called the SEPA. Now, I was the third person in U.S. history. Manuel Noriega was the fourth. As a matter of fact, Ollie North was the fifth. The SEPA is an acronym meaning the Classified Information Procedure.